And we are back with episode 681 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville. And my, it works so well when the Google Calendar finally syncs up.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm looking forward to some of this week's news.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and tonight's technical difficulties are brought to you by literally everything.
Indeed. Although we do, yes, we do also have a guest voice in the background that would be, well, somebody playing the Division. But that's okay. We are literally better off right now than we've been for the last hour. So we're just going to pave through. So we are going to be bringing first off in this episode some genre news, and then we're going to get into maybe some episodic discussion. But before we do any of that, Edmund, if you could give a general disclaimer.
Absolutely. We always try and spoil you silly with whatever we tell you. When it's news, we hope you're happy. If it's episodes, catch up.
That's right. That's right. Good. All right. So we are going to start off with some news coming out of NBC. And this is good news for some of us, at least. Those of us who enjoy the show Grimm. That's right. Grimm has been officially renewed for season 6 by NBC.
Yes.
Yes. The Friday night drama series will keep going as the supernatural crime drama has received another early renewal by the network for a 6th season. Grimm was a lower profile entry when it debuted in the fall of 2011, alongside another fairy tale themed drama that is still going strong, Once Upon a Time. The NBC drama, produced by Sean Hayes and Todd Milliner, became a sleeper hit, the first scripted success for the network's new regime, and the only series from Bob Greenblatt's first batch of shows that is still around. So that's a really amazing thing here. Grimm joins previously renewed NBC dramas The Blind Spot, Shades of Blue, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, Chicago Med, and Law & Order SVU, as well as comedy Superstore. So NBC is starting to shape up their fall, well, at least their 2016 to 2017 schedule. Who knows if it's the fall or not. A little bit of extra information here. This season, Grimm's original episodes are averaging a 1.7 rating in adults 18 to 49 and 6.4 million viewers overall in Live Plus 7. So it is one of the most time-shifted series on the broadcast networks, growing by an average of 90% in adult 18 to 49 rating and more than 2.4 million viewers overall from Live Plus Same Day to Live Plus 7. Grimm also generates an upscale audience, indexing at 111 among adults 18 to 49 living homes with 100K plus incomes. So, boy, I guess it's people with disposable income, so they like having a show that is being watched by people who are willing to spend money on the things that they maybe advertise and occasionally see if they don't fast-forward through the commercials.
Yes, since most of them are watching on their DVRs, exactly.
Exactly. But I'm pretty happy about this, Gary. It sounds like you are, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the show, I don't want to say they do a complete reinvention of themselves every few seasons, but they definitely turn a different, you know, go down a different route about every year to a year and a half, and it helps keep the show fresh, I think, which is nice. I was always worried when we had started off with our formulaic Vesson of the Week, and I'm glad it's grown through since then.
Mm. Yes, indeed. All right. Moving on then to a different network. This would be Fox, and they have renewed a show as well. There it is. They've actually renewed two shows here. Fox has renewed freshman dramas Lucifer and Rosewood for second seasons. Regarding Lucifer, which is the only show we really talked about here in any detail, we knew we had something special with Lucifer, from the engaging performances of Tom Lauren and the rest of the charismatic cast to Len Wiseman's visually stunning look of the show and the amazing storytelling savvy of the Bruckheimer team. Lucifer is averaging 10.5 million total viewers across platforms and is Fox's second highest rated new series this season among adults 18 to 49. And I'm rather impressed by that because the first few episodes were not good enough for us to continue with it. So I'm glad to know that the fans of the show are going to get at least the second season out of it. I will say this, the main character Lucifer was a lot of fun. It's just everything that was around it just was not speaking to me. So it's not a terrible show. It just was not a show for us, or at least for me. But good news out of Fox for the fans of that show. All right, and Edmund, if you could move over to the cable world.
Absolutely. This is news from the newly introduced network Freeform, which I believe is what ABC Family has morphed into. In addition to, news that we're about to reveal after this, they also announced that they are going to be doing a remake of the UK sci-fi dramedy Misfits, which debuted over there in 2009 on Channel 4, featured a group of delinquent British teenage teens who get caught in a freak electrical storm and gain superpowers. In addition to all that, it was notable for going on with their normal routines, including lots of community service, just with a little more murder and relationship drama ensuing.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't enough words to describe why this is a bad idea.
Yeah, the original UK series is one that's been on my list for a while, but I haven't gotten to, and I may just to watch the original and not worry about this.
The original is good for a while. By the end of season 3, pretty much every character you actually like has dropped out of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So wait, it's basically another situation like Being Human UK?
It is extremely similar to Being Human UK. And not helped by the fact that the guy who created the show and was the showrunner, by about series 3 or 4, he was also working on other things. The main one that comes to mind is that he did that Dirk Gently series that only ran 3 episodes and really should have kept going because it was amazing.
Yeah, fortunately or unfortunately, they're going to be rebooting that, so we shall see what that's like.
Yeah, if they're not giving Stephen Mangan a call, then I'm very skeptical.
Yes, well, I'm sure that eventually we'll get more news about that particular show, but for now, also on Freeform, we're going to be talking about a little bit of Marvel news. And Freeform has greenlit Marvel's Cloak and Dagger, a new romantic superhero series based on the Marvel Comics heroes of the same name. The series will follow runaway teen heroes Tyrone Johnson, a.k.a. Cloak, and Tandy Bowen, a.k.a. Dagger. Created by Bill Mantlow and Ed Hannigan, the crime-fighting duo have fought alongside Marvel icons like the X-Men and Spider-Man in their adventures. In their comic book origins, Cloak and Dagger came from very different social backgrounds, but met as runaways in New York City. They are then subjected to scientific experimentation by New York City criminal organizations and end up with superpowers. Dagger can create light daggers and has some healing capabilities, while Cloak is connected to a darkless dimension that gives him powers of tangibility and teleportation, coupled with a constant hunger for light. I don't know about any of you out there. Maybe Gary, you're pretty familiar with Cloak and Dagger too, but this was actually one that I really enjoyed back when I first started reading comics, because there was a relatively short run of Cloak and Dagger that was done with art by Arthur Adams.
Yes, really there was a miniseries. Cloak and Dagger has been around for a long time, and as they say, for many years they were integral towards Marvel. You know, the typical crossovers and any large events, they were usually always featured. And their powers have always vacillated between magic to mutant. And I believe at one point they did sort of settle on mutant, and their powers were just triggered. But especially Cloak, per se, they've always had this sort of mythic thing, as he's got this cloak that all the darkness comes under. And I'm not sure where they'll go with this. And honestly, while their romantic angles did enter their storylines at some point, it was much further down the line of their development, as they had been working together for apparently what was years. And his desire, what they say, this hunger for light, is almost like a drug addiction in some ways. At least that's how it began to be portrayed, where Dagger would give her light, which was almost like they equated it to her soul, and it would replenish herself after a while, but she could only do so much, and eventually his hunger started to exceed what she could provide, and so it lent itself to a lot of drama there. And then sometime during this symbiotic relationship was when the romance started to appear, peek out a little bit more and more. So I'm curious how heavy they're going to go into this romance. Are there going to be a couple when it starts, or are we going to get to see things unfold over time? Often, though, it's a gritty thing, because, as they said, they were found as runaways. And if I remember their powers originally, it had something to do with drugs that were being tested on them by the criminal syndicates. Possibly the Kingpin was involved, and they did have some run-ins with him. So I was wondering if they were actually going to appear in Daredevil, but I guess the powers are a little too much for Daredevil's type of drama, but they definitely are a street level type of characters. They're not fighting intergalactic battles or anything like that. They were always very much working the streets, trying to help other runaways and things of that nature. So that's where it was originally grounded, and I'll be curious to see where they take it. But they do have a great backstory, and I'm looking forward to the show. I hope they can do them justice without I don't know if the word teening it is an actual word, but I hope they don't teen it too much.
Yeah, I'm guessing just from the network that it's on that it's probably going to skew a little bit family friendly and, like they said, maybe ramp up the romantic side of it just a little bit more. But it's always been in the DNA somewhere of that of their characters. So there it is. But I'm curious as to whether or not it will be actually officially part of the MCU or if this is going to be more of a side thing that's on its own, not unlike Legion on FX. But it's hard to tell for right now. The fact that they have Marvels in front of it seems to suggest that it's actually part of the MCU because that's what they do with a lot of the Netflix things.
Yeah.
And if the recent DC crossover is any indication, the fact that they're on that a bunch of things are on different networks doesn't preclude some sort of odd crossover.
I would say it even encourages it, given that this is Disney we're talking about, and they own all of these channels. It's not like jumping from CBS to CW.
Well, aren't CW and CBS have a parent network or a parent company or something like that? But you're right. It's the fact that it is all under this umbrella makes it probably a bit easier, and the fact that DC has done it and been so successful is probably an incentive for Marvel to give it a try.
Yes, indeed. All right, let's see here. I'll actually take this just to prevent any type of shenanigans from Skype, but it's a relatively short thing anyway. Apparently, for those who are fans of Game of Thrones and have noticed that one of the big things that's going on these days is these after shows, perhaps most infamously the Talking Dead coming after The Walking Dead and so forth. There's a few of them out there that are starting to perk up in terms of shows having the cable shows at least having after shows. And now the Game of Thrones is going to have one. They have announced After the Thrones, a Game of Thrones after show hosted by Andy Greenwald and Chris Ryan of the website The Ringer. After the Thrones will debut on April 25th, one day after the premiere of Game of Thrones. So it's not going to be one of those immediately the hour after situations where it is on AMC. Anyway, After the Thrones began life as a podcast hosted by Greenwald and Ryan on now-shuttered website Grantland, which was created by The Ringer founder Bill Simmons. Simmons and HBO signed a deal in 2015 to co-develop new content, and After the Thrones' transition to television is the first fruit of that agreement. It will be available to stream on HBO Now, HBO Go, and via HBO On Demand. There are currently no TV air dates for the show, but that may change. Okay, so that would be the big difference, is that this is going to be more of supplementary content, but hey, an after show nonetheless. So this is becoming a real thing on cable, it seems. Let's see. Edmund, this is great news for those of us who are fans of a certain high-functioning sociopath.
Yes, indeed. Season 4 of Sherlock has, in fact, finally begun filming, since the various stars did have their schedules have finally synced up. Benedict Cumberbatch, of course, just finished filming on Doctor Strange, as people might have noticed, since they did a bit of a social media avalanche there during the final days of filming. Martin Freeman has also finished up on Captain America: Civil War, which means that yes, they are finally filming Sherlock 4. Not as ever with Messrs. Moffat and Gatiss, etc. Not a lot of information about what we are actually going to be seeing. They do continue to insist that Moriarty is definitely dead, but then again, they've insisted all sorts of things that have turned out to not be true. But they have let us know that it will be dark. And there will be some big stuff in the series. This will be following up from the Abominable Bride, of course, at least the present day versions. Pregnancy of Mary Watson will apparently be featured in some regard, as one might expect, even though it does seem like it's been forever since we learned that little detail. About the only other thing we know is that American director Rachel Talalay is directing the first episode, which will be the first female director on Sherlock. She is also the woman who was behind the final two Doctor Who episodes, Heaven Sent and Hellbent, in the last season, and also episodes of The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah, she. I think she also worked on the last two episodes of season 8 as well, series 8. And yeah, she's been working on The Flash and a few other shows, and directed a couple of films, the titles of which escape me right now. But I know I just remember seeing them and thinking, yeah, you know what? I'd focus on Doctor Who as well.
Yes,
indeed. It's great news that she's going to be involved. She's a fantastic director. She knocked it out of the park with her her Doctor Who stuff.
Yes, indeed. All right, let's see. Well, I don't think we have too many worries about what the quality of Sherlock is, at least from the directorial side, is going to be. So that's something. Moving over to online or alternative networks. Netflix, once again, kind of killing it here. No pun intended. Director Adam Wingard has been one to watch for years, but with works like Your Next and The Guest, his next film may reach an even bigger audience now that it's likely headed to Netflix instead of theaters. Death Note, a manga adaptation, which has already been an anime series, a video game, and a live-action film series in Japan, was originally going to be made at Warner Brothers. Instead, it will be shepherded by Netflix, which stepped in when the original studio pulled out shortly before production began. Yes, so Netflix also intends to cast its War Machine star Keith Stanfield, rather, though he does not have an official author or offer, as the streaming service hasn't closed its deal to acquire the project yet. Wolf will play a student who... Nat Wolf will be playing a student who discovers a supernatural notebook that allows him to kill anyone simply by writing their name. A cat and mouse game ensues when he's tracked by a reclusive police officer. Yes, so there is some suggestion that this is connected to Warner Brothers' recent discussion or announcement that it will be making fewer films and making more franchise fare for various reasons. Financially, one would imagine. But there we are. So Death Note going to Netflix, perhaps, which is yet another big coup for Netflix lately. Gary, why don't you take this next one, if you don't mind?
Sure, no problem. I guess, yeah, this was still alternative news. It was recently announced that production has stopped on the Galaxy Quest TV show following the death of Alan Rickman. As is being reported... By Sam Rockwell, who played Guy Fleegman in the original movie back in 1999. Everyone was ready to sign up to come back to the show. And after Alan had passed and Alan's schedule became locked in as he got a new show, nothing quite came together anymore. And they didn't know what to do and how to handle the loss of Alan Rickman. And as a result, it appears that everything has been pretty much shelved at this point. So those of us who were hoping to never give up and never surrender once more might just have to.
Yeah, that's sad, but I can understand why that's happening. I mean, not knowing their plans for what they were going to do with that adaptation, it's hard to really say, but I'm guessing that kind of the air went out of it when Alan Rickman died. So that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then moving over to movie news, talking about the air falling out or leaking out. Oh, this one is not going to be fun. But Batman versus Superman has managed to break a new record. The biggest Friday to Friday drop for a major big budget comic book movie. Yes, as the article says here, one can talk all they want about how the movie is more appreciated by the fans or its fan base or by the critics, but if the second Friday is any indication, the majority of the populace no longer cares about the movie. Granted, it's still got about 15 million plus on the second Friday and more than 50 million on the second weekend, but apparently the drop was somewhere around 81% from its opening day, which is the biggest... drop for a major big budget comic book movie yet. So that's unfortunate, but it is worth noting though that this is not the record for any movie, because while the plunge is a bit jaw dropping as it says here, even if it's not a record for all saturated releases, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 dropped 84% on its second Friday, and High School Musical 3 dropped 90%, though that was a Halloween, so perhaps that would have mattered for that. But still, 81% drop is a pretty bad indication when most of the time the drop is about, let's say, 50 to 60%. So, unfortunate for sure.
Yeah, but not really surprising given the sort of word of mouth that I was giving it and friends of mine were giving it. I mean, it's also notable that this is a case of it dropping that much without really anything that was going to compete with it for big box office opening on that second weekend.
It was a weekend of everyone went and saw it when it came out, and apparently no one's been really that inclined to go back to it. I mean, given all the chatter about it, all the reviews and the word of mouth and stuff like that, I mean, it doesn't seem too surprising to me. Anyone who was going to go see it has seen it already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, we'll see, because obviously it's by comparison, if other films have generally done better, I guess other people are going to see it multiple times versus just the once. But we'll see. I mean, Deadpool obviously had a much better tale than this movie does, for instance. So, but that's true on many respects, I'm sure. Edmund, why don't you go ahead and take this next one? A little bit better news.
Yes, this is news of another live-action anime adaptation. This is Full Metal Alchemist. Is going into production and development with plans for a 2017 release. And Fumihiko Sori will be directing the film. What I have to assume is member of a Japanese pop group, Heisei Jump, Ryosuke Yamada, will be starring as Edward Elric. They'll be filming this summer in Italy. Yes, there will apparently be heavy use of CGI to recreate the fantastic elements of the comic, such as Alphonse Elric's armor, which, kind of makes sense for those of us who are familiar with the original.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I'm passing familiar with this one. It's oddly enough, you'd think that was one that I had already sampled, but no, not quite yet. But I do know enough about it to know that it should be interesting visually, that's for sure. All right. And Gary, why don't you go ahead with this one? Speaking of Deadpool.
Yes. Deadpool, among its many distinctions, has now earned another one. It is now the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Wade, obviously, people love him. People love him a lot. According to the latest numbers, Deadpool has topped over $746 million, which now puts it above the Matrix Reloaded movie that came in at a paltry $742 million. Domestically, it is still only number three, however, earning only about $350 million in the U.S., but that's still, still not bad. It has yet to beat American Sniper at $350 million or Passion of the Christ at $371 million, so it's still within striking distance. We'll have to see. I guess people enjoy an R-rated superhero.
Yeah, especially one that is has a fairly broad appeal, at least in terms of the sense of humor and so forth. All right, Edmund, this is great news for those who have been waiting with bated breath for more news about The Kingsman.
Yes, indeed. The Kingsman sequel, which will be coming out next year. We've gotten a little bit of casting news up until now, but we can now reveal the film's subtitle. It is going to be Kingsman: The Golden Circle. As previously announced, as we know, Taron Egerton and Mark Strong are returning. We also now have more details about Julianne Moore and Halle Berry's roles. Julianne Moore is playing Poppy, the villain of the new international story, and Halle Berry will be heading up Kingsman's American counterpart organization, Statesman. What cracks me about this, for those of us who remember the rumors that Halle Berry's Gambit character from the Bond films is going to get a spinoff, I think the writers were playing with that a little bit here. Some art was revealed showing the Kingsman headquarters in ruins, indicating something dastardly occurs that sends Eggsy and Merlin off to the United States, where they meet up with Barry's Ginger and her top spy, Jack, a swaggering, sharpshooting cowboy, whose casting is unannounced as of now, but I think that might change later in the program. we also learned that the Statesman's headquarters is disguised in a whiskey distillery.
please tell me that Kingsman 3 and they get to come out to Australia.
and just in case we weren't sure that they might have been filching on their longer lived forebear, there is going to be gadgetry, including a car that can turn itself into a submarine.
See, no, what I want is, like, okay, so we've got the first one where it's like this this riff on like the classic, James Bond, the British spy films, like Avengers and all that sort of stuff like that. I'm really hoping that the Statesman, it's like they're really playing on like Get Smart and Mission Impossible.
Yes.
Like just overly gadget, like crazy over gadget heavy and like oddly specialized teams and stuff.
So many possibilities. So many. All right, let's see. Moving on then to some news out of Warner Brothers, who, once again, as we were alluding to not so long ago, is doing some weird things with its choices about its future releases. Here's a few of them. Warner Brothers has shifted the release dates for its upcoming films Wonder Woman and Jungle Book. It has dated three more currently untitled films along the way. Jungle Book is moving back an entire year from October 2017 to October 2018. This is one of two competing films based on the book of the same name. Disney's version comes out on April 15th. I was about to say, why are we hearing about this now? And that's very strange. In the DC Cinematic Murderverse news, Wonder Woman, which will star Gal Gadot, who made her debut in Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, is moving up from June 23rd, 2017 to June 2nd, 2017. So roughly 3 weeks or so. It has also set two dates for two of its, as for now, untitled DC films. So, one will be in October 2018. The other will be in November 2019. These dates are set to be for yet-announced films and are in addition to the already dated DC films, which include Suicide Squad coming out this August, The Flash in March 2018, Justice League Part 1 in November of 2017, Aquaman in July of 2018, Shazam in April of 2019, Justice League Part 2 in June 2019, Cyborg in April 2020, and Green Lantern Corps in June 2020. All of those dates, of course, more than subject to change. So, and what's very interesting here is that it says down at the bottom here, the latest film, Dawn of Justice, plunged 69% in its second weekend. So now we've seen at least three different numbers for how much the movie plunged. But it's somewhere between 69 and 81, apparently. Someone will make up their mind.
I think the theme here is that people want to present the idea that the movie is just completely failing.
That is something that is probably a valid interpretation, let's put it that way. Let's see here. I'm meaning that the narrative seems to be very negative in terms of the current way that the press is handling it. Gary, if you don't mind taking the next one.
Absolutely. Let's see. Yes, this is an announcement that J.J. Abrams is going to be doing producing a new film based on a graphic novel called Dream Jumper. And as they say, it's good to be king. Well, apparently being friends with the king isn't that bad either. This graphic novel has been written by J.J. Abrams' close friend Greg Grunberg, who we might be familiar with, I guess, from Heroes is probably his biggest claim to fame. And they offer the following synopsis for what this story is. The story follows a boy who discovers he can jump into other people's dreams, but that power turns into a nightmare, literally, when his friends begin falling into an endless sleep and something in the dream world wants the boy's abilities for itself. The graphic novel is being currently published by Scholastic, and it's the first one should be released in June of this year, so it is just coming out, so don't feel that you've missed it as of yet. There also isn't much more information than what I've really just read to you. There's no writer or director attached to the project. We don't even know if it's going to be animated or live action, but you know, with J.J. Abrams behind it, I imagine that it will get money to move forward. So I don't think it'll languish. I just think they're not sure which way to go with it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, interesting turn of events there. And it seems like being J.J. Abrams' friend continues to reap great dividends. But there we are. Edmund, I've not heard a whole lot about this project.
Yes, this is in remake news. Hollywood Reporter has reported that Sean Levy, the man behind the Night at the Museum films, is set to direct and produce a remake of the 1984 sci-fi romance Starman. Of course, originally directed by John Carpenter and starring Jeff Bridges as an alien who crash lands on Earth and assumes the form of the husband of a widowed woman, played by Karen Allen, and was notable for, wonderful performances from both stars. Jeff Bridges actually was nominated for an Oscar, one of the rare times that a science fiction film to get recognized in that way. this is one that where the original film was a real case of capturing lightning in a bottle. Feeling very, very trepidatious that the man behind Night at the Museum and Real Steel and Date Night getting his paws on this.
I'm just surprised that it's a film with star in the title and J.J. Abrams hasn't got his hands on it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. It maybe wasn't a big enough franchise, despite the TV adaptation that was around for a little while. I remember enjoying this movie quite a bit when I was a kid, actually, despite the fact that it's a romance. It actually had a lot of interesting ideas in it, but not the TV show so much. I don't remember that being quite as high quality, but there we are. And finally, rounding out the movie news, we have news about the Edge of Tomorrow sequel. Well, it apparently has a writing duo. This Edge of Tomorrow, of course, hit the theaters back in the summer of 2014. Didn't get a whole lot of praise, but it was a bit of a dud actually here domestically, but overseas it did much, much better. And it's built itself a fan base due to its various storytelling inventiveness. So
it's a hugely underrated film.
Absolutely.
Like, if you're listening and you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. Don't be put off by the fact it's Tom Cruise. Don't be put off by the fact it sounds like Groundhog Day with Gatling guns. Just trust me, it's a really good movie. It's worth your time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yes. It's based, of course, on a relatively well-known novel, All You Need Is Kill. But anyhow, according to Deadline, the team of Joe Shrapnel and Anna Waterhouse, and what a great name for a screenwriter, Joe Shrapnel, anyway, will soon get to work on the script for the sequel. They are just coming off the narrative success in February from their acclaimed historical drama Race, which depicted the perception-shattering performance of Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin that also served as a monumental middle finger to the Third Reich. The Shrapnel-Waterhouse duo were also recently tapped as script doctors to rewrite the suspense thriller The Gray Man, which will star Charlize Theron. While Edge of Tomorrow seemed to present itself as an odd amalgam of Starship Troopers and Groundhog Day, Ronstam, to your point, its obvious science fiction elements appear to be secondary considerations to the selection of the Shrapnel-Waterhouse writing team, who had yet to touch anything remotely close to the genre. However, those who saw the ultimate plot resolution of Edge of Tomorrow will know that the film's storyline should be dramatically flexible in the sequel, a set of circumstances that could end up complementing their talents. So that's good news, I would say, for those who are looking for the sequel to maybe be a bit of a different animal from what the original was.
Joe Shrapnel sounds like a character in Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes. Absolutely.
Certainly.
He sounds like he should be in charge of like a ragtag group of Marines fighting to save the universe from aliens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that means that we are in one of our favorite parts of the night, and that is casting news. And Gary, if you don't mind starting us off.
Oh, absolutely. This is news I'm more than glad to report. The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. spinoff, I guess actually that is the title of it, Marvel's Most Wanted, has announced casting updates. Besides, of course, Adrian Palicki and Nick Blood returning, starting off the new series. They've also announced Delroy Lindo will be joining as the character Dominic Fortune, who also has a strong Marvel history. They're, of course, not going to actually be in S.H.I.E.L.D. because, as we saw the tearjerker in the last few weeks, they did have to leave the series and were disavowed. So while they haven't really laid out the new plot line of this, they do like the idea of feeding in more and more characters. They're going to basically be, well, from what they have said, they are going to be sort of on the run because while they were in S.H.I.E.L.D., they made a lot of enemies and they're trying not to get killed. So at the same time, they are going to try and offer their unique services to people who are in need. So I don't know if it's quite going A-team or not, but I suppose we'll just have to see.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Okay, and next on the list, we have a little bit of news about Oscar Isaac.
Yes, we have learned that Oscar Isaac is going to be reuniting with his director from Ex Machina, which, of course, is the other film we've been telling you all to go see in recent weeks, if you haven't seen it yet. But that's Alex Garland, and they are teaming up for a sci-fi thriller called Annihilation. According to Tracking Board, Isaac will be starring alongside Natalie Portman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Gina Rodriguez, and Tessa Thompson, which is adapting the first novel of the Southern Ranch trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer. Story centers around a biologist, played by Portman, who, in seeking answers to her husband's tragic disappearance, volunteers for a government expedition into an area sealed off as an environmental disaster zone. What she discovers, however, is pristine wilderness and a mysterious dark force within it. Scott Rudin is producing, along with Andrew McDonald and Alan Reich. Eli Bush will be actually overseeing the project for Rudin, Paramount's involved as well. This will start filming later this spring in London.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. All right, next on the list, we have some casting news for the aforementioned Kingsman: The Golden Circle. They have added another name to it, the growing cast, actor Pedro Pascal. As revealed by Deadline, Pascal, who previously played Oberyn Martell on Game of Thrones and was recently seen in Netflix Narcos, is said to be playing a character named Jack Daniels. I wonder which side he's on.
Whiskey Distillery Headquarters character named Jack Daniels.
Yes.
Yeah.
Could his name be Whiskey Tango Foxtrot?
It could be. It's quite possible. All right. Pascal joins a cast that consists of lead actor Taron Egerton and new additions Julianne Moore and Halle Berry. The first poster for the Kingsman sequel also teases that Colin Firth's character, Harry Hart, may return from the grave for the next installment.
Ooh.
Ooh. All right. Next on the list is a little bit of news for Arrow, Gary, if you don't mind.
Yes, and while some people might be very happy about this, it worries me. Anyway, what we're announcing is that we're going to start seeing a lot more of a character that has been somewhat in the background in recent Arrow episodes. Curtis Holt, also known as Echo Kellum, who plays the resident tech wizard in Palmer Technologies, has been promoted to series regular for the fifth season of Arrow. He was introduced earlier this season as, I guess, Felicia's right-hand man, and now that he's discovered the secrets of the Arrow Cave, or the bunker if you prefer, they have decided to bring him into the inner circle. Mr. Holt's character has been sort of teased a little bit because they've shown some spheres that he has, and that's very reminiscent of Mr. Terrific, an Earth 2 character, I guess, or at least how it originally started out, and who is an African-American scientist that comes up with different types of technologies to both defend and help him investigate things. So whether or not we'll see Mr. Holt putting on a mask anytime soon, I can't say, but it concerns me that he's going to take Felicity's place, and I'm not that happy about that. So hopefully she comes back soon and they find a new role for him to fill.
That did occur to me when they made this announcement, and with the way that this season of Arrow has been going in these past few episodes, it does almost seem like they're positioning him as to fill that role within the team.
He will not look as good in a dress, so I don't like.
We don't know that yet. just to roll back a bit, you said that Mr. Terrific was an Earth 2 character?
Yes. Yes, he started off as an Earth 2. There were actually two of them. Mr. Fairplay, yes.
I'm wondering if perhaps they're going to pull a Killer Frost and not necessarily have the Curtis we know become Mr. Terrific.
They've been teasing with it when Felicity was blowing up the elevator in one of the more recent episodes without really going into stories. She was holding two spheres and they had a T etched into them, at least as far as I could tell. So that was pretty
bright. I've noticed that too, not knowing much about the character other than the fact that he is a sort of tech guy called Mr. Terrific. I picked up on one or two references, but I'm wondering if they're maybe going to have in some sort of DCW crossover, we're gonna meet some of the Earth 2 equivalents of Arrow characters, and maybe that's the version of Curtis who's become a full-blown superhero, kind of in the vein of what they did with Caitlin and Cisco in The Flash.
That's possible, although I always had the sense that the show era was never quite going to go into that realm, but I could be mistaken.
I think that they're going to be, this season they've been more, as the show's going on, they've been more and more okay with getting more fantastic and whatnot. I wouldn't be surprised if going into season 5 of Arrow they were okay with embracing some a bit more Flash-esque elements, even if they do approach them in sort of their more serious, dramatic Arrow fashion.
Well, true. As you saw the ratings from the Supergirl Flash crossover, and we know in the past the ratings have been good when Flash has appeared on Arrow. I can agree with what you're saying that they might like to go back and grab that ratings bump again.
Mm. Possibly. All right.
Plus, just imagine Deagle going to Earth 2. Just think about that for a moment.
Interesting. All right, let's see. What is next on the list? We have next, Edmund.
Yes.
This is our last casting bit of news for the night.
Yes, and this is news. BBC Three revealed the cast of the upcoming Doctor Who spinoff, Class. Assembling for the first day of term are Greg Austin, Fadi El-Sayed, Sophie Hopkins, and Vivian Opara, each of whom will play a student at Coal Hill School, joined by Catherine Kelly, who plays a teacher and powerful new presence at the school. Creator Patrick Ness introduced the cast and gave fans a look at the half-built set for the show. Principal photography, as this goes out, will have just about begun. The Coal Hill School has been a fixture of Doctor Who since the very first episode of the franchise. Class will explore what it's like to be a student at a school where the Doctor's periodic visits and the infrequent time travel jaunts of faculty like Clara Oswald have caused the walls of space and time around the campus to become thin. As the BBC description says, there's something pressing in on the other side, something waiting for its chance to kill everybody and everything, to bring us all into shadow.
So it's Buffy.
Yes, so it would appear. On a certain level, anyway. All right, let's see here. Unfortunately, we do have a few entries in our least favorite segment of the news hour, and that is In Memoriam. A couple of these are not necessarily genre-related, but they are of some note. The first one here is James Noble, best known as the scatterbrained Governor Eugene X. Gatling on the sitcom Benson, if you go back that far with a few of us here, passed away at the age of 94. Born in Dallas in 1922, Noble served in the Navy during World War II. Once the war ended, he studied at the newly founded Actors Studio in New York, eventually pursuing a stage career in the late 1940s. He began his career in the 50s by appearing in soap operas such as The World Turns, Another World, and One Life to Live. He continued to guest star on shows like The Love Boat and Starsky and Hutch well into the 1970s. But again, his best known acting role was on the series Benson as the absent-minded governor who often receives help from the head of household affairs, Benson Dubois. So unfortunate, but at least he had, it seems, quite a good run. Next on the list, Edmund, if you don't mind.
This week we also lost Patty Duke, most famous for playing Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker at just age 16, for which she won an Academy Award, and also, of course, starring as the identical cousins on The Patty Duke Show. She was 69, died from actually complications of a ruptured intestine, which sounds quite unfortunate and nasty. Her career was one of these cases of one way where she kind of got to her major roles early on. Her film career was sporadic after The Miracle Worker, also got a lot of attention for the Valley of the Dolls, the Russ Meyer classic, where she played against her squeaky clean image as a pill popping alcoholic, perhaps also her major connection to genre material is, of course, being the mother of Sean Astin of Lord of the Rings fame, and was actually married to John Astin for a while in the, from the 72 to 85. He actually adopted Sean. That's how Sean got the Astin name. And the two of them also had another son together, Mackenzie, who is currently playing on Scandal, as well as being Andy on The Facts of Life. Certainly she has had major successes in that early part of her career, certainly is going to be missed.
Yes indeed. And then finally we do have one entry here related to our genre, and Gary, I think that this is probably in your wheelhouse.
Yes, and it's probably in a lot of people's wheelhouse, actually. You won't know the name offhand, but you'll know his most famous quote. It's a trap. The actor, Eric Bauersfeld, passed on at the age of 93 and is most notably known, at least within our circles, as the voice of Admiral Ackbar. He also voiced Bib Fortuna, who was Jabba the Hutt's right-hand man. And he recently did actually do the voice in the most recent Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, as well. So who they'll get to fill those shoes, I'm not quite sure. But I'm sure all of us can just close our eyes and hear his voice right now. And if for nothing else, we're grateful for all the enjoyment that his talents have brought to us.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Certainly that is... Well, with the resurgence of Star Wars, I guess it's unfortunate whenever we lose those who were working on the films back in their original heyday. So, yes. Let's see. I think we do have at least some time left here, right, Edmund? What would you say about 15?
I would say more like 10.
Okay. I think that's still more than enough time to cover some of these. As we move then into... the episodic discussion, and unfortunately, I don't remember offhand exactly which week these shows would have aired in our usual parlance. So, Edmund, real quick, a disclaimer for the episodic stuff.
We will discuss whatever we liked or didn't like about these episodes, so if you haven't seen them, you'll be spoiled.
Okay, so these are the bottom three shows for the week ending roughly, say, about March 30th. And let's see, we are going to start off here with Bitten, Season 3, Episode 7, On the Brink. Nick, Paige, and Rachel use magic to track Katya after she kidnaps baby Rocco. I'm not going to go any further with that particular one. It got a 7. Not a lot happened in the episode. As you can probably tell, it was a little bit dreary. I wasn't really all that thrilled with it. And it's kind of sad for there to be episodes like this when the end of the series is so near. The next two shows both fall under average. And the first one here, Edmund, if you don't mind taking it.
Absolutely. This is Elementary, Season 4, Episode 18, Ready or Not. A survivalist doctor goes missing, and Holmes and Watson must determine whether he purposely went off the grid or is a victim of foul play. Meanwhile, Sherlock exhibits odd behavior when his romantic relationship with Fiona hits a rough patch. I gave this a 6.5, primarily because it was them slipping back into the old bad habits of a case that didn't really require much beyond regular police work. Not really any major deductions going on. The stuff with Fiona, which I think does in terms of the way they were setting things up, did have some interest. Just felt very, very pedestrian as well. So it was sort of a elementary back into their procedural rut, unfortunately.
So it would seem. All right, and that means that for the week ending March 30th or so. The bottom show the very bottom show is Arrow, Season 4, Episode 16, Broken Hearts. A heartbroken Cupid returns to Star City and begins killing couples on their wedding day, which prompts Oliver and Felicity to pose as bait. This episode coming in at an average of 6.25, and Nadim's comment here pretty much says it all. An embarrassing hour of Arrow. Let's never speak of this one again. Ooh, that's pretty bad. Brosnum, you gave this one a 6.
Yeah, it was pretty weak. I think a big part of the problem I had with it was that I just don't like Cupid. I don't think she's a good villain. I don't think she's very interesting.
yeah, I don't really know how to argue with that, because my comment here is essentially the same thing, that the character is woefully miswritten and, in my opinion, also miscast. I mean, you don't even have an actress playing the part that is really bringing anything to it that could maybe help elevate what is a very thinly created character, in my opinion. It just makes the whole episode hard to enjoy. I mean, there's some nice banter between Oliver and Felicity because of the whole fact that they're not supposed to be together anymore at this point, but
yeah, I mean, that was essentially my reaction as well. I mean, that's why, I mean, I wound up giving it a 7, but more because while the Cupid stuff was woeful, the fact that it did allow Oliver and Felicity a chance to kind of talk things out in a relatively mature fashion was the part that sort of counterbalanced that for me. But yeah, we certainly could have done that without having Cupid around.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. That's for sure. All right. Well, what we'll go ahead and do is wrap this one up. And when we come back next time, we're going to get into the top three for the week ending roughly the March 30th. And yeah, we'll see what we have to say about all these other episodes. Here's a little bit of a tease. These episodes were down to 6.25. Our top three for that week were all 9 or above. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, watch, read, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.